Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
It's the end of a long week. In a matter of possibly hours, Congress will be asked to approve a plan to bail out banks from the bad debt that led to the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. Ah, we love the smell of rescue in the morning. Financial apocalypse now? It's the takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, September 19th. I'm Catherine Lamb for Infra Adora Udoji and John Hockenberry. In this hour, the latest from the markets and Congress, the growing scandal over tainted baby formula in China, and expert advice for anyone on Wall Street or Main Street who finds themselves looking for a job. Plus, golf's Ryder Cup begins without Tiger Woods, and we look at some famous musicians who know a thing or two about bailouts, including one we're pretty sure Alan Greenspan would have approved. Those stories are coming up. But first, Femi Okeh is here with these headlines. Hey, good morning, Femi.
Hello there, Catherine. Good morning, all. The Bush administration is asking Congress to give it the power to buy distressed assets in an attempt to rescue banks caught in Wall Street's financial crisis. The plan is meeting bipartisan support, but not everyone in Congress is happy. Texas Republican Congressman Jeb Hensarling says that it's time for the government to stop fixing Wall Street's problems.
House conservatives are here today to say enough is enough. It is time to bail out the American taxpayer from bailout mania.
Congress's plan could take some immediate pressure off the two remaining major independent investment banks, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley. Europe's markets are rising strongly after similar gains in Asia. Share values recorded significant gains in London, Paris and Frankfurt. In Moscow, stocks rose so sharply that trading was briefly suspended. The news bolstered U.S. markets yesterday. The Dow gained more than 400 points to close up 3.86%. And the Dow futures are already up more than 335 points before the open.
The Treasury says it will provide temporary guarantees for U.S. money market mutual funds. And the SEC has announced an emergency ban on short selling. The unprecedented move is in response to this week's extreme market volatility. A recent wave of short selling and false rumors have been blamed in part for the demise of investment firm Lehman Brothers and other large financial companies.
And on the campaign trail, Barack Obama is meeting today with key business people, including Warren Buffett and former Fed Chair Paul Volcker. And Obama plans to unveil some new proposals in Florida to calm the nation's financial crisis. Yesterday, John McCain said among the things he'd do is fire the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. McCain speaks in Green Bay, Wisconsin, in about an hour. Then he's off to Minnesota. Catherine.
All right. Thanks, Femi. Hey, before you go,
yes.
What'd you have for breakfast?
I had haggis, I had half a turkey, a bowl of porridge,
okay,
some black pudding.
Okay, obviously not going to get the true answer. We'd like to know what you had for breakfast, though. It's all part of our discussion, a new report that shows that when the economy tanks, the sale of breakfast food goes up. So let us know, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or send us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Haggis. Sausages, bacon,
my
eggs.
Foot, you did not eat haggis.
Fried fish.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, I'm Catherine Lanford, in for both Adora Udoji and John Hockenberry. As you know, we're continuing to follow the developing news on the markets this morning. The Treasury Department announced just earlier that they will insure the holdings of some money market funds. And within the next few hours, Congress could be asked to approve a rescue plan for the nation's banks. It's been called the biggest intervention of its kind since the Great Depression. We're going to turn now for the latest to Todd Zwillick. He's with the Capital News Connection. Now, Todd, we know that both Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke and Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson made their case last night to members of Congress, and they continued to meet with members of Congress throughout the night. What was the case they made?
Well, the case they made seemed to be the case that lawmakers started talking about by around 4 or 5 o'clock yesterday, which is that immediate intervention is needed and that the government is going to have to take some of this rotten debt off of the hands of the banks with some money, hold that debt, and as some lawmakers have been saying, get some of that bad paper that's clogging the system out of the system. There's a consensus building around that concept now. Exactly how they do that remains to be seen, but that's the message they came with.
Okay. Now, we've seen so far this week, the Wall Street Journal has called it a patchwork approach to fixing this problem. So how systemic is this plan?
Well, we don't know what the plan is. We don't know what the plan is yet. When they came out of the meeting last night and we were all sitting there waiting for them, the impression that they gave and the impression that they intended to give is that everyone is on the same page, even though this is an election year. So you had Republican leaders, bicameral banking committee, bicameral bipartisan Republicans and Democrats with Bernanke and Paulson, everyone coming out and making sure to deliver the same message. And that's by design. There's no question about that, that they expect a plan from the administration, from Paulson and Bernanke, one assumes. They said within a matter of hours. We'll see if that means, you know, by today or maybe perhaps Monday or over the weekend. They expect a suggestion, a plan from the administration, and that Congress would work hand in hand to get that done. That's the message, and I think that message is designed to provide some confidence to the markets and to the public, frankly, who are very, very worried that everyone's going to be very adult and try to get something done. There are some things in play that could make that difficult, but we'll see.
Well, I want to get to those in a minute, but it is interesting that there's such a bipartisan approach here because it was, I believe, just earlier yesterday, let's go back to that term of measurement hours, when we were hearing from members of Congress who were so nettled by the AIG deal.
Right. And it remains to be seen how nettled they remain. Like I said, the message last night was we're all on the same page. And then come the details. I think that there's a real sense this problem is very, very real. And there is a time for seeking advantage and winning, i.e. elections, beat the other guy. And there is a time for using your authority to solve a problem. And it's going to be very interesting to see how those two imperatives play against each other.
You said earlier that it was time for everyone to act like the adults they are, but that there were things in play that could possibly stop this. What are you talking about?
Well, Democrats want an economic stimulus, first of all. They have been angling for a second stimulus that has money, has an injection of money for the things that they hold dear: transportation projects, infrastructure, unemployment insurance, food stamps. Early yesterday, these things seemed to be slipping off the table. Democratic appropriators around Congress were saying stimulus isn't going to get done. The president won't sign it. It's just not really going to happen. They were starting to accept that it wasn't going to happen. Well, now that seems to be starting to change. Speaker Pelosi sent a letter to the president last night, right around the time that this meeting was happening, saying, "Mr. President, we stand ready to stay in town past the adjournment date of next week to get this market plan done because it's so important, and to enact a stimulus that's also important." So what is she saying? She seems to be sending the signal that cooperation on the stimulus may be part of the price of getting the administration's priorities into this rescue plan. Then the other side of it is Republicans, conservative Republicans, who were very unhappy with AIG, very unhappy with what they call government bailouts of various investment banks. And they've been circulating letters around their own rank and file: no more bailouts. We don't want to do this anymore. And Richard Shelby, the senior Republican on the Senate Banking Committee, came out last night. He didn't say he wasn't on board, but he said, skeptical, and we're going to have to review all this. And his spokesman put out a statement later in the night saying it's responsible to be skeptical about this. So, yes, we're all on board. Yes, we're all cooperating. Yes, we're solving a problem. But send us the details, and we'll decide exactly how much we're cooperating.
All right. When those details come out, I hope we talk to you again. Thanks for joining us, Todd.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
He is our man in Washington, Todd Zwillick, with Capital News Connection. Now, also this morning, Treasury Department stepping in to ensure the holdings of some money market mutual funds, Securities and Exchange Commission temporarily banning the practice of betting against financial company stocks. You might know that by short selling or shorting. With us now to look at the likely impact of all of this when U.S. markets open this morning and how global markets are already responding, we're going to go to Jeremy Batstone Carr. He is head of research at the Charles Stanley & Company stockbrokers in London. And Jeremy, I would just like to remind you that when you were on the show Monday, you said it was crucial that there was some kind of government repository created which could, if you will, store these bad debts in order to ensure stability. All right, you got
That's
your way.
Right. Yes.
What's your reaction now?
Well, I am absolutely delighted by the news that such a vehicle is under active consideration. I am as delighted as that about that as I am appalled by the regulators' attempts to curtail short selling. It looks to me very much as if the authorities continue to give with one hand and take away with the other. So two cheers rather than three.
All right. Now, explain your opposition to the ban on short selling, because, of course, it's being sold as a ban on greed that hurts others. So give us the other side of short selling.
Okay. Well, I fully accept that short selling exacerbates strains in financial markets. But consider this. The past decade has seen the explosion of the most unimaginable amount of leverage and debt, and so much so that the financial system globally, and particularly in the West, is absolutely awash with it. So essentially, what has to happen before we can close the chapter on the credit crisis is that we have to see further and massive-scale consolidation in the financial industry. We have to see mergers, we have to see acquisitions, and we have to see consolidation. Any attempt by the authorities to prolong that process, that necessary process, is necessarily going to prolong the credit crisis.
It's interesting. This sounds like something akin to what former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan was saying earlier. It also sounds like you're saying that it needs to get tougher in the short run to be better in the long run.
On the contrary, I think that the ban on short selling is a very poor decision. I think that whilst it may be politically expedient to do it, because, of course, no politician, particularly in an election year in the United States, wants banner headlines across all the newspapers regarding bank mergers and substantial redundancies. And yet, at the same time, financial institutions have binged incredibly hard over the course of the past 10 years. A vast amount of debt has now been built up. If we are genuinely going to get to grips with this huge deleveraging process, there has to be further consolidation. Now, hedge funds, through their actions, are doing little more than speeding up that process. Regulators, by their actions, are doing little more than slowing down that process. And I, for one, am disappointed about that.
Tell us what the market reaction is in London so far.
Okay, well, three things are driving the markets at the moment. Firstly, of course, we have the news of the lifeboat, which we all wholeheartedly are delighted about. Secondly, of course, we have the ban on shorting financial stocks, which, of course, has caused a huge amount of short covering today, which is a significant contributory factor. And thirdly, of course, we have this so-called triple or quadruple witching, in which options and futures contracts expire, which in themselves tend to create an undue amount of volatility. The net upshot of that is that as we speak, the FTSE 100 is up over 8%, the DAX in Germany is up 4.5%, and equities across the board in Europe are all significantly higher.
Jeremy, I hate to short sell you. We are down to seconds, but I am very curious to know what you make of the back and forth with Russia's markets.
I think that it is indicative of the fact that investors in general are spurning emerging markets. They want security associated with the dollar. They want security associated with U.S. equities or even, strangely enough, Japanese equities. They do not want emerging markets at this time.
All right. We'll keep an eye on all of this. Jeremy Batstone Carr, thank you so much for joining us. Jeremy Batstone Carr is head of research at the stockbrokers Charles Stanley & Company in London.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Friday, September 19th. I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for both Adora Udoji and John Hockenberry. Now, jobs on Wall Street actually started shrinking more than a year ago. Some 25,000 jobs already gone before the events of this week kicked in. Now, if you're at the top of the heap on Wall Street, you're going to be okay, probably. But what if you're one of the thousands expected to hit the bricks? Marcy Alberher runs the New York Times blog Shifting Careers, and she's been working the phones to find out what is facing the newly unemployed. Hey, Marcy.
Hey, Catherine.
Now, let's start with the events of this week. What does it look like for the thousands of financial workers who find themselves now looking for a job?
Well, first, I was making some facial expressions at you because that's kind of how I feel. It doesn't look good. I don't think we can sugarcoat this right now because in the near term, it's pretty bleak.
Now, you started working the phones to cull advice. What did you hear?
I think what I heard, the single most important thing that I heard is that for all industry veterans, people have been watching or have experienced other kind of down cycles before, that this is the worst anybody's seen probably in their lifetime or at least in their memory.
Now, if we are talking about a job market, as I said, that's really was already shrinking before this happened. So what pressure does that put on people to reinvent themselves?
It puts lots of pressure, not only because the job market was already tight, but because the industry that they're going to reenter when they get new jobs is going to look dramatically different than what they left.
Give me an example.
Consolidation. You know, there will be fewer investment banks than there used to be with mergers and acquisitions like we've seen with Bank of America and Merrill. So when there are two entities come together, obviously there's duplication. So people are going to have to figure out how they fit in to the way things are shaking out.
You know, I have to say, you deal all the time with experts on how to get a job, how to shift your career, and they're usually really perky people. So you must have heard some bright notes.
Oh, yeah. I've heard some bright notes. Okay, so here are some of the bright spots. And I think this is all about what you can apply in your own life. You know, the proverbial rainy day has arrived, okay? So if you have some kind of cushion or if you've been prudent, this is the time to say it's okay to access that. And some of the ways people are accessing that is get some new education, retrain, get skills. Don't ever think this is actually a really good time to invest in your career if you know there's something you need that would help you. For those who are flexible, I'm hearing about lots of opportunities outside New York, and I think that's something that the banking people really need to be thinking about. There are opportunities in other places out in the U.S., in places like Charlotte, which is a banking hub, Delaware, home to, you know, the corporate home to many companies, and really overseas. And people say that in India and Dubai and other places in the Far East and in parts of Europe, I'm not saying necessarily boom times, but certainly much better than what's happening here.
Now, how does this crisis go beyond New York?
Well, it goes beyond New York in some interesting ways. I mean, I was talking to people in the venture financing world and in the small business community who say, you know, we have just seen a complete restriction in the capital markets. So small businesses and mid-sized businesses looking for funding have just had their options shrunk. And the same thing goes for anybody wanting to get insurance right now. AIG has really changed that landscape. So outside New York, the ripple effects are far and wide. I don't think we're seeing anywhere near the local. Here we have a local kind of a lot of local effects where you're seeing proximity businesses affected, retail businesses, restaurants, services that helped the banking industry like limo companies or restaurants and travel agents. I don't think we're going to see those kinds of businesses affected in a big way outside New York.
You know, you just mentioned, you know, a tertiary business like, you know, a limo company. Talk about some of the responses that you've been getting to your blog post when you have addressed what people in the financial sector can do if they found that they've lost a job.
Right. I mean, there's always some cheerleading and some, you know, look at the bright things that you have in your life. This is a time to value family and friends. And then I have to say there was quite a lot of unexpected, to me at least, resentment and cynicism about what's happening.
Schadenfreude, perhaps?
Exactly. Let me read you a couple of real brief ones from a reader named Philip. There was also some enthusiasm about the foreign opportunities. Here's someone who wrote from Dubai. I completely agree. I was in New York working for 3 years following college. I saw a downturn and now find myself in Dubai. It's like shooting fish in a barrel out here. Come and get it while you still can. But some of the reveling in angry comments, here's one. I have little sympathy for those who made their money in finance. Let them sell off their houses and assets and live like the rest of us. So I saw a lot of that kind of comment.
We have such a high unemployment rate, 6.1%, the highest in 5 years. What sort of advice in general do you give for people? Because if they're already unemployed and they're hearing this news, you've got to think it's going to be even tougher.
Yeah, I mean, the advice I'm giving to everyone these days and I'm hearing for everyone is really the same. Look at your own industry and look at how it's changing. I mean, right here we're sitting in the media. Our business is changing, right? Our industry is going more online, going more interactive, right? How much time do you spend talking to the listeners out here and asking them to communicate with you? So in the banking industry, what parts of the business are being changed by technology, going online? The business of trading is totally changing. It's become an online algorithm-based model that a lot of people are finding new opportunities in. Staying in touch with your network, key. This is a time where people are reluctant to pick up the phone, and the first thing you need to do is pick up the phone and talk to your contacts. But you need to just get outside of your immediate contacts and get to what are called the weak ties, because that's where most people find jobs. So you need to be networking with the contacts of your friends, the contacts of your family.
All right. Speaking of networking, I'm going to ask you to ride along and stay with us for the rest of the hour. This is Marcy Alberher. She writes the Shifting Careers blog for the New York Times. Now we're going to turn to Femi Oke and the latest from the newsroom.
Thanks, Catherine. The time is just coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. The government is working on a plan to rescue banks from bad debts. The legislation could take some of the immediate pressure off the two remaining major independent investment banks. That's Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, to reach deals to ensure a steady flow of funds for their operations. I almost changed the sex of Morgan there. Sorry about that. California lawmakers have made it illegal for train operators to use cell phones on the job. The ruling comes after last Friday's commuter train wreck in Los Angeles that killed 25 people. Investigators say the wreck was caused when an operator sending a text message ran a red light and crashed head-on with a freight train. In Texas, a nearly 50-year-old law may stop hundreds of people from rebuilding their beachfront homes wrecked by Hurricane Ike. The Texas Open Beaches Act says that the strip of beach between the average high tide line and the average low tide line is considered public property, and it's illegal to build anything there. The storm eroded beaches so much that many houses close to the shore are now on public property. And finally, a new report in the journal Science may just have come up with a reason why it's difficult to change voters' minds. From the University of Nebraska, they took some hard-hearted political viewpoints from people who have very strong political views, mm-hmm. and they tested them. They tried to scare them with loud noises and scary pictures. And they found the people who were most likely to be startled were tending to be right-wing. And the scientists said, though, there's no political reason for doing this, but it does show us why it's hard for us to change our political viewpoints because it's kind of inbuilt to our personality.
Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer cash rewards to students for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it like merit bonuses in business? Viewpoints at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for both Adora Udoji and John Hockenberry. And sitting next to me is Marcy Alberher. She is the Shifting Careers blogger and columnist for the New York Times. All right, Marcy, what'd you have for breakfast this morning?
Well, at this hour, I had what I call stage one breakfast, which is a banana. After the show, I can go back for stage two.
I like a woman who divides breakfast into stage one and stage two. Well, a new report shows us that when the economy tanks, the sale of breakfast foods goes up. So, as you're starting your day, we want to know, are you like Marcy? Do you have stage one, stage two? You know, is phase three a cream puff? What are you having for breakfast? What does it say about how you're doing economically? What does your breakfast look like in lean times and in good times? Listen to this.
Hello, this is Cynthia Elliott from Framingham, Massachusetts, and I wanted to let you know that my breakfast usually consists of a banana and a plum, or a banana and grapes, and when I can't afford it, which is kind of around this time, is I just eat a breakfast bar, which the company provides.
All right. Well, we would like to know what stages of breakfast you're in. Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email, mytake@thetakeaway.org. A different sort of food discussion here, a tragic one. Shops and supermarkets across China have been withdrawing dairy products after the revelation that liquid milk has been contaminated in addition to powdered baby milk. The government quality watchdog said nearly 10% of milk samples taken in recent days from leading Chinese dairies contained the industrial chemical melamine, which makes the protein content appear higher. Four babies have died, more than 6,000 children have fallen ill as a result of the contamination of the powdered milk. We're going to go now for more on this story, which has been gradually gaining attention, to Michael Bristow. He's the BBC China correspondent. This scandal seems to be growing and growing. What is the latest?
Well, I think you've just retold us there what the latest is, that today the Chinese authorities revealed that it's not only powdered milk. This scandal began with powdered milk. It's not only powdered milk that's tainted with melamine. It's also liquid milk, fresh milk that people are buying from the shops and supermarkets. And the three brands which have been found to contain melamine are not just any old brand. They're three of China's top brands, sold all across the country. So, of course, you know, people, parents and anybody who drinks milk are concerned. I mean, the government is actually saying that you're going to have to drink a lot of this liquid milk to get ill. In fact, you can drink up to 2 litres a day and it won't affect you. But, of course, that's not reassuring parents and anybody who buys dairy products. They're just, you know, not going to the supermarkets and buying it because they don't trust it.
Well, I would think that the death of four children and all the different children who were ill would certainly counter any assertions from the government saying it's okay.
Well, yes, I mean, what the government has been trying to do is kind of put a lid on this while being open and revealing as much as they know, or trying to reveal as much as they know. That's what they're saying. They're also trying to put a lid on it. So they've been saying, for example, the baby milk scandal, the four babies that died and those that became seriously ill all drank milk that was made from milk powder of one particular company that's called the Sanlu Group. And while the other baby milk powder from 21 other companies was found to be adulterated with melamine, no one has been taken seriously ill from drinking that. And also from this liquid milk, nobody so far has been reported as being taken ill. So the government's trying to distinguish and make a difference between the various products on sale. But of course, I mean, I've myself got two children. If you've got children and you're feeding them milk, you know, it's not really much of a reassurance that he's going to make you rush out to the shops and buy these products.
What do we know what is behind the contamination of the milk? How much is it tampering by milk companies? How much of it is an accident?
Well, the investigation's taking place at the moment, but with the main company, the Sanlu Group, the early indications are that people actually put melamine into the milk. Why did they do that? Well, they water down the milk, make it go round further, make their profits soar. But if they do that, the milk gets weaker. So they add melamine to raise the protein content. The test for protein mistakenly identifies melamine as protein. So it makes it look as though these dairy farmers who are supplying these big companies with milk, it makes it look as though they're supplying a lot of good quality milk when they aren't. So it's actually there are unscrupulous suppliers who are just putting it into the milk. Also, it has to be said, the enforcement of rules is not very good in China. These cases, they happen regularly. What happens is that local inspectors are often paid off by companies to turn a blind eye, and that's what they do. And so this toxic milk gets into the system.
Now, what about rumors that this tainted milk, the problems with it appeared as early as May, but was hushed up in part because of the Olympics?
Well, that is the rumor that's going around, and you've got to remember, in China, it's not like being in America or the Western world, where we're more open about things when they go wrong, and there's more access to information. In China, you don't usually hear about anything, and it's very, the government has the control over information, so they're not really being very open and honest about this aspect of it. But as you point out there, the suggestions that there were reports as early as March this year that their children were becoming ill after drinking milk made with formula powder. And even in August, at the beginning of August, there's a suggestion that the company, the Sanlu Group, the company at the centre of this, knew about it and told local officials in the city where they were based. But this information just wasn't passed on higher up the chain to national level, and it was only just last week when these food products were recalled from the shelves. So that's weeks, apparently, after these officials from the company knew, it was weeks before action was actually taken. So, I mean, if this comes to light, then obviously parents will be even more angry than they are now.
Michael Bristow, I want to thank you for joining us. Michael Bristow is the BBC's China correspondent, and he has been following this growing milk scandal. And we're going to turn now for more news around the world. Femi Oke is here with the latest from the newsroom. Hey, Femi.
Hello there to you, Catherine. Good morning all. Coming up to 20 minutes to the top of the hour. Urgently moving on multiple fronts to stem the worst financial crisis in decades, the government announced plans this morning to take two historic steps. First, the Treasury will tap up to $50 billion from a Depression-era fund to ensure the holdings of eligible money market funds. Second, the SEC has temporarily banned on short selling on nearly 800 financial institutions. This is all happening as the Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson and Fed Chair Ben Bernanke are crafting massive rescue plans to buy up dodgy assets held by troubled banks and other financial institutions at the heart of the nation's financial crisis. North Korea says that it plans to rebuild one of its major nuclear reactors after almost completely disassembling it earlier this year. The North accuses the US of failing to live up to its commitments under the disarmament deal. Specifically, the US refused to remove it from the US terrorism blacklist. And California state lawmakers have officially banned train operators from using cell phones while on duty. The engineer on a commuter train that crashed last Friday was sending text messages when he missed a red light, and the train crashed, killing 25 people. And that's a look at your news.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm sitting in today for Adore Udoji and John Hockenberry. And by the way, it's Friday, September 19th, just in case you were keeping score at home. Now, here's something else you should be keeping score at home about. As you know, the 37th Ryder Cup is going to begin today. 12 Americans gathering outside of Louisville, Kentucky to take on a European team of equal size. And if you've been keeping score, as I said, the U.S. has not done very well lately. To use a non-golfing term, we've been clobbered, losing 5 out of the last 6 tournaments. In the last 2, we had Tiger Woods on the team, and we got clobbered. This year, we're tigerless. And to get an assessment of our chances, we're going to go to Golf Week senior writer Rex Hoggard. He is in Louisville. All right, Rex, what chance do we have without golf's greatest player?
I think clobber is right about the right word. Let's stick with that for right now.
Do you like that? Is that a golfing term? I don't think it is.
I think J.B. Holmes, who's a member of the American team, hits the ball about 5,000 miles. He clobbers the ball, so that maybe we can make the transition.
Now, see, this is going to replace my other favorite golfing word, which is divot. Okay, now, what are we up against with this European team?
You know, it's going to be an uphill climb. I mean, as you pointed out, even though it's a home game, I mean, without Tiger Woods, any team's going to be nowhere near as strong as we were before. And U.S. Captain Paul Azinger spent the last 2 years, he changed the system a lot. He went to a one-year selection process. He had got one more, two more picks, so he had to make four free captain's picks. You know, all trying to even the score. We've lost by 9 points the last 2 years, so it's really been a lopsided affair. You know, I think if America can make a game of it the first 2 days, we have a chance. But it'll all probably pan out here first thing Friday morning.
Hey, now, I read one analysis that said that we should embrace the fact that we're the underdog, that we can actually make it work for us.
If they can. I mean, it's funny, in this affair, that it always seems like the captains are fighting for the underdog label, just trying to one-up the other guy because they always want to motivate their teams that way. And let's be honest, with Tiger Woods on the team, it's hard to call the Americans the underdog. But obviously this year it's much different. I don't think anyone's debating that the Americans are not the betting favorites either here or in the U.K. So, I think that's part of the motivation that Paul's trying to go after. I think, the other thing is it's a home field advantage, and he's got two Kentucky players on the team, so the crowd's going to be behind him even more so than normal.
And is that unusual to have two players from Kentucky on the home team?
No, Kenny Perry, who he's played on a Ryder Cup before, but he really made making this year's team his primary. I mean, that's what this was all about for him. As soon as he found out that the Ryder Cup was coming here to Valhalla, which is about an hour from Franklin, which is where he was born and raised and still lives, J.B. Holmes, who I mentioned before, lives about 2 hours from here, went to school at the University of Kentucky. They are going to, the crowds are going to, it's going to be Wildcat Blue.
Oh, hence the home team advantage. Yeah. Now, who cares more about this tournament, the players in Europe or the players in this country?
Well, I think the what everyone seems to fall back on is to say that the Europeans care more. That's why they play better. I don't know if that's fair. I think the Americans may care too much, to be quite honest with you. They get out here and they look a little tight, and you see them on the golf course and they don't look loose. They look like they're about to take a math exam. So I think actually the Americans look too tight.
Well, and we all know math exams. No one ever scores well on those. Okay, Rex, thanks so much. Rex Hogard, senior writer for Golf Week magazine. The Ryder Cup, the 37th one, begins today. We'll check in later on that.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
It's Friday, September 19th. I'm Catherine Lanfer in for both Adora Udoji and John Hockenberry. Now
you're
we're going
awesome. Two people. You're covering two people by yourself. Let's change the name of the show so when they come back, they don't recognize it.
That's my colleague Femi Oke is going to give us the latest from the newsroom.
Good morning. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Only joking, John and Adora, in case they're listening online. The SEC has decided on a short-term ban for short-selling shares in almost 800 financial companies. They say that they're following Britain's lead. Regulators there banned short selling yesterday. The practice has been blamed for helping to drive down the price of several financial institutions. At the same time, Congress is working with banking officials to develop a plan to rid banks of the bad debts that are at the heart of the global financial crisis. Stock markets around the world have risen sharply on news of the plan. Share values in London, Paris and Frankfurt have all registered significant gains. And stock markets in Asia also rallied. The Dow futures are up more than 350 points in pre-market trading. In Iraq, the US military says that at least 7 people have been killed in a raid by US soldiers backed by aircraft. It says that 4 suspected Sunni militants linked to Al-Qaeda were among those who died, along with 3 women. The mayor of Galveston, Texas, says the city is not in ruins, but it remains a mess, and she's asking people to stay away another week. And finally, cyber squatting. That's where internet addresses are bought up cheaply in the hope of reselling them to a business that might want them.
FemiOK.net.
I can't get a website for my own name. But market-savvy cyber squatters have been doing some buying this week. And last week, when they were watching the financial news, they bought up bankofamerica.com/MerrillLynch, Lloyds.TSB/HBOS, and we've also got BarclaysLehman.com. So those websites are already out there and owned by cyber squatters. So if the banks want to buy them, they have to buy them off the cyber squatters for however much they want to sell them for.
Probably more than femiok.net.
Yeah. I don't think they'll accept my $1.
Okay. Thanks for the news, Femi.
You're welcome.
This is a reminder as well that with me here is Marcia Albaher. She writes the Shifting Careers blog for the New York Times. Marcia and I are talking with WNYC's evening music host, Terrence McKnight, because believe it or not, the bailout is not the sole preserve of Wall Street. Musicians have long since mastered the art of getting saved from financial ruin. Terrence McKnight is going to tell us about three very different musicians who were thrown the financial life preserver just in the nick of time. All right, Terrence, three amazing names: Handel, Charlie Parker, and Wagner.
That's right. This, you know, I'm reminded of something I heard Branford Marsalis say.
Yes.
Branford said, if you want to become a millionaire by playing jazz, first you have to start with $1 million.
That's good advice for a lot of things.
But it doesn't just apply to jazz music. I mean, we see that composers, artists have struggled for years. I mean, let's talk about Wagner. This is one of his most recognizable, famous tunes. And Catherine, I'm just glad that you didn't play the other one. It might have confused our listeners. Dum bum ba bum be dum da da. Yeah. So this guy.
Well,
Wagner,
Terrence, I am sweet on you.
So this guy Wagner, what led him into financial straits was his artistic ambitions. He wanted to create these huge operas, and for a while he was doing very well, but he had these bad habits, you know. He liked to spend a lot of money, he liked to chase other men's wives, he borrowed money from creditors, he ended up running all over Europe, running from his creditors. He lived in Paris. He tried to conquer that city.
Who rescued him with all these bad habits?
1864, there was a young king, King Ludwig II of Bavaria, and he heard Wagner's music. He heard Lohengrin, the Here Comes the Bride thing. He heard that as a young man, and when he became king that year, he wrote a letter to Wagner. He said, I'm going to wipe away all your debts. I'm going to build you a house. I'm going to build you this big opera house to play your music. And that's what saved Wagner in 1864. He lived to 1883. So King Ludwig of Bavaria rescued Wagner.
I'm writing this down. My plan B. Meet King of Bavaria. Okay. Now, what about Charlie Parker? You have him on your list as well.
I've got Charlie Parker on my list. He's a little more difficult to pin down because Charlie Parker, born 1920 in Kansas City. And Kansas City was happening. I mean, you've had, you know, this was during Prohibition. You had, you know, drugs that were kind of legal, and you had prostitution, you had gambling. It was a 24-hour nightlife happening in Kansas City. Charlie Parker grew up in that environment, and he, you know, started to partake of some of this nightlife happening, but he also partook of the great music that was happening. Jay McShann had come to Kansas City in 36, and Charlie Parker started playing with him in around 37, and so he transitioned from the blues to this, what we're hearing now, bebop. And this is perhaps the first bebop recording, a tune called Coco. Charlie Parker's issue was, you know, he had an accident, had some morphine, and got addicted to heroin. And so throughout his life, there was not one person because of the drugs. If you have anybody in your family who is abuses drugs, you know it takes more than one person to rescue that person. So there were a number of people, his family, his friends. You know, he hawked his instruments. He hawked other musicians' instruments. And he ended up having a nervous breakdown and spent some time in the hospital. And came out the hospital and was okay for a few years and went back to that lifestyle. So in the case of Charlie Parker, it was a bunch of folks. It was a community to save him.
That's the one that I think Alan Greenspan would have approved because he's such a lover of jazz, the former Federal Reserve chairman. I could see him going, all right, let's try and save Charlie.
Well, there was a baroness towards the end of Charlie's life, Nika de Koenigswarter. And there were a lot of musicians who wrote
Terrence,
music for her.
This is my new plan B. Meet a baroness. Okay.
So the baroness, right towards the end of Charlie Parker's life, you know, he spent time in her apartment. In fact, he died in her apartment right across the street from the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Now, let's move on to your third one, George Frideric Handel. Talk about his problems.
Well, Handel, you know, he should have listened to his father. His father said, well, maybe he shouldn't have listened. His father said, I want you to go to law school. Son, go to law school. Don't pursue music, you know. And so Handel couldn't resist that pull that music had on him. And so Handel, you know, he was very cosmopolitan. Born in Germany, went to study Italian opera was the big thing then. So he went to Italy, studied opera and learned opera for about 3 years. And then he wanted to conquer England. So he moved to England, and he brought these Italian operas to England with him. And so he wrote all of these Italian operas that were a hit for a while. And then the English grew tired of Italian opera. They wanted to hear something in their own language. But Handel was determined to make a living with Italian and opera, and at some point, you know, it stopped working for him. And then the year he was going to retire, 1741, he gets a libretto from a guy named Charles Jennens, and it was the libretto to Messiah. Handel composed Messiah, took it to Dublin, and it was a huge hit. And it's been a big hit ever since.
All right. So he kind of bailed himself out with his own talent.
And the Messiah. Maybe Messiah bailed him out.
Plan B. Now, I was just going to say, we have Marcy Alberher here who writes about shifting careers. I saw you perk up when Terrence was talking about law school.
I still think if you've got this real talent within you, going to law school may not be the best advice, and a lot of people are still getting that advice from their parents.
Well, you know, in the case of a musician, you know, it's great to have that law experience. Then you can perhaps negotiate some of your own contracts.
I knew the two of you were going to make beautiful music together. Terrence McKnight, thank you so much. Thank you so much. Terrence McKnight, he's host of WNYC's Evening Music. And Marcy Alberher, the Shifting Careers columnist and blogger for the New York Times, want to thank you as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Catherine.
The Messiah. And I'm Catherine Landfer, in for both Adora Udoji and John Hockenberry. You know, there are lots of ways to catch up with all three of us here at The Takeaway. You can find us on Twitter, Friend Feed, Facebook. We're talking about Congress and credit. And we're also following tainted baby formula and now milk, too, in China. And we're also hearing about how you eat breakfast. A new report shows that the sales of breakfast food goes up when the economy goes down. So what's on your plate this morning? Hank in Brooklyn sent us this email. I had some blueback salmon, and separately I smeared crunchy peanut butter in rolled cabbage leaves. But that was just because I was out of yogurt, which I usually have with crunchy cereal. Here's what another one of you said.
Good morning. This is Troy calling from North Dakota. And to answer your breakfast menu question, I have a suggestion that is not only cheap, but way healthy / nutritionally excellent. Take old-fashioned raw rolled oats, mix it with raisins and honey, then pour soy milk on it like cereal. Let me tell you, this is superior energy and endurance fuel. It will get you to lunch and way beyond if you want it to, and if you eat it consistently, it will also lower your cholesterol.
Okay, this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Wall Street is wobbly. Unemployment is up. Oh, we know it's early. You want some good news. Well, a new report shows that when the economy tanks, sales of breakfast foods go up. Think of it as good news from the breakfast board. Sales of cereal up, a rise in Cheerios, Frosted Flakes making a small dip but coming back strong. Yogurt, fruit on the bottom, stable, low fat, ticking up on shares today. Breakfast, the newest economic indicator. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, September 19th. I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for Adore Udoji and John Hockenberry. Now, along with breakfast this morning, we're also going to look at other ways the economic meltdown is affecting the country. Plus, we check in on some swing counties that will really count in the upcoming election, and a look at gender and politics, plus a female GOP candidate for vice president. Hint, it isn't Sarah Palin. Those stories are coming up, but first, Femi Oke is here with these headlines. Good morning, Femi.
Good morning there to you, Catherine. Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson and Fed Chair Ben Bernanke are putting together a massive rescue plan to buy up some souring assets held by banks and other financial institutions. Congressional leaders say they expect to get it today and will act quickly. But the plan is not making everybody happy. Texas Republican Congressman Jeb Hansalim.
House conservatives are here today to say enough is enough. It is time to bail out the American taxpayer from bailout mania.
News of the plan is causing Europe's markets to rise strongly after similar gains in Asia. Share values recorded significant gains in London, Paris and Frankfurt. In Moscow, stocks rose so sharply that trading was briefly suspended. And the Dow futures are up nearly 400 points before the bell.
In other financial rescue moves, the Treasury Department says it will tap into a Depression-era fund to insure the nation's money market mutual funds. And the SEC is temporarily banning the short selling of financial stocks. Short selling is a common practice in which traders bet against company stocks.
Former Soviet Union President Mikhail Gorbachev is urging Condoleezza Rice to lay off Russia. In an unusually scathing criticism yesterday, Rice criticized the country for its incursion into the Republic of Georgia.
Russia's leaders are making some unfortunate choices, but they can still make different ones. Russia's future is in Russia's hands.
Gorbachev defended Russia's military action and pushed for greater cooperation between the U.S. and Russia. And heading out to the campaign trail, Barack Obama is meeting today with key business people, including Warren Buffett and former Fed Chair Paul Volcker. And Obama plans to unveil some new economic plans in Florida. And McCain will also be talking about his economic plans in Green Bay, Wisconsin, within the hour. He then heads to Minnesota for a rally with Sarah Palin.
All right, Femi, okay. When you're having a great day.
Yes.
What's for breakfast?
Oh, tripe, chicken feet and kidneys and sweetbread.
No wonder you look so fabulous. Okay, I don't believe a word of it. But we do have this new report that says when the economy's down, breakfast food, the sales of them go up. So we'd like to know what's for breakfast at your house. 877-8-MY-TAKE. MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Tripe. I don't believe you for a minute.
Delicious.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, I'm Catherine Lanfert. Takeaway political director Andrea Bernstein will be visiting several counties that count in this election. She started yesterday with Lucerne County in northeastern Pennsylvania. George W. Bush won that county in 2000, but John Kerry won it in 2004. And in both cases, the race was practically tied. This week's focus, the overwhelming bad news on the economy. Now, Andrea's with us, and she's going to help us get a handle on some of this. Hey, good to see you, Andrea.
Good morning, Catherine.
All right. Tell me a little bit more about Lucerne County.
So politically, this county is mostly Democrat, but a lot of those Democrats cross party lines and vote Republican. One of Hillary Clinton's most supportive counties used to be coal country. It's along the Susquehanna Valley in Pennsylvania, lots of green mountains dipping into it. Coal left, then textiles came, and we all know what happened to that. Now, the big issue in this county right now is jobs. So I posted myself yesterday outside of the job center where people were going in to get retraining, and spoke to lots of voters who were undecided, weren't sure where they were going to go, like this woman, Debbie Sitze, who was pretty clear on what she thought John McCain represented, but still said she was undecided.
McCain, I think, is another 4 years of Bush. I really do. I think he may do some things a little differently, but the bottom line, it's going to be another 4 years of Bush. And if people want that, if they like the way things are now, then go ahead and vote.
So you think you just might vote for Obama, even though you don't really like him?
I'll have to wait until that time comes.
Wow, there's so much on the one hand, on the other hand there. What's she really saying?
There is. There were a lot of people that were really wavering. There were a lot of people that had voted for Hillary Clinton in the primary. And there were certainly, I would say, more people who were willing to vote Barack Obama. Quite a few people said, well, I'll vote for him with a clothespin on my nose than I saw when I was out last summer. But there's still some decision-making going on there. One woman I spoke to, Lisa Ryman. She was a farmer. She was out in the farmer's market selling her peaches and apples and peppers. And one of the things that she said did affect her was the selection of Sarah Palin. And she liked Sarah Palin. She said, well, she's tough. I like her. Then I said to her, well, what about the economic news this week? How does the economic news affect your thinking? And all of a sudden, she sort of reconsidered who she was voting for.
I think McCain is too pro-Bush. And Bush ruined this country, I think.
So you got a little tug about the Sarah Palin thing, but you think he might go Democrat.
I think. I don't know. I don't know yet.
Okay, here's what I love. You know, the nuanced voter. I feel a tug towards Sarah, but that's a tug. That's not the economy.
Right. And it made me think that, you know, this really was, you know, even though there was all of this sort of anti-Obama stuff in the atmosphere, that the economic news really did get people thinking about their core economic conditions. And that probably really did help Obama this week. It's reflected in the national polls. But there were plenty of people who were out there and they were supporting McCain, even though his sort of, you know, questions about his experience on the economy came up. But people just like the fact that he's experienced in general. Here's Kelly Mahadi. She was out there with her daughter, Malia, which is, by the way, also Barack Obama's daughter's name. But she's pretty clear about who she's for.
On the economy, there was certainly some bad economic news this week. Do you think John McCain has enough experience on the economy?
I think time will tell when he's president. I do. I think he understands.
Okay, can I just say this? I love it when people who aren't in the media or in politics use phrases like, time will tell. Why didn't she just say, I have no comment at this time?
You know, I mean, I think it's an interesting thing because while McCain is known as getting some tough legislation through Washington, he's not necessarily known for his leadership on economic issues. One of the things that was also so fascinating is with all of the talk of lipsticks and pigs and all of the advertising and all of the negative ads that's been on this week, Obama has been relentlessly repeating this line about the fundamentals of the economy are strong. There's so much information out there this year. It's such a different information environment that when I spoke to voters, they were following some storylines, but some of them were completely beyond them. Here's a woman who didn't want to give her name.
You know, did you hear that McCain said this week that the fundamentals of the economy are strong? Did you hear about that?
Well, that I don't necessarily agree with. But, you know, I sometimes it's taken out of context. And the other candidate also said some things.
Well, yeah, it actually sounds like sort of a nuanced reading. I mean, things are taken out of context.
I mean, when people are for somebody and they get negative information about that person, and I saw this both with McCain supporters and Obama supporters, they were pretty willing to dismiss it. So even though Obama in his ads has been trying to mock McCain with his own words, McCain supporters aren't buying it. Now, I did meet some Obama supporters who were very sort of energized by some of the things that have been going on. So when you attack the other candidate, that it does energize your own base, and clearly that's something that both candidates need to do. Now, one of the things that was really very upfront in Pennsylvania, and one of the things that became really clear to me as the day went along, and you know, I sat down and I spoke to somebody who I'd met in my previous trips to Pennsylvania, he repairs spots. He's an Obama supporter. He was a Republican. And I spoke to him in April, and he said, the big issue in the campaign is race. And he came back and he said that to me again. The big issue is race. People are afraid of Obama. They tell me they're afraid of a black man. They don't, you know, they are afraid because they cross the street when they see one coming. And it's something that I, just walking into the town square in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, I found it too.
Well, the Republicans have been in there 8 years and they haven't done anything so far. That's why I'm sort of bending to going with the Democrat. And if Hillary were still running, it would be no problem. But I don't have to give my name, do I? Because I really don't want a black man in there yet. You know, I'm not ready for that. They're taking over.
Wow. How often do you hear that off the record as well as on mic?
Well, I heard it quite a lot, and I had even some stronger statements said to me yesterday. So I think that one of the things that is clearly going on in this race is, even with all the economic news, which would normally push voters firmly away from the party that is not in power in the White House, people are still really grappling with race in a big way.
Now, Andrea, we are joined right now by Rebecca Traister. She covers gender, media, and politics for Salon.com, and she also has been covering the election in Pennsylvania. Rebecca, you were nodding your head earlier.
I was nodding because, in fact, just yesterday, not just in Pennsylvania, but in Rudy Giuliani's words, cosmopolitan New York City, I heard somebody in a drugstore. I was in line at a drugstore, and there was a picture of Obama on the front of the paper. This was an older woman, and she just yelled, I'm not ready. I don't want a black man as president. And this was, you know, you don't hear it as much in New York City, but I heard it just yesterday afternoon, and that clip sounded so familiar to me.
So do we have a race, forgive the redundancy, but do we have a presidential election that is going to center on race versus the economy?
Well, I think what is happening in areas like this county in Pennsylvania, Lucerne County, which is a swing county, is that Obama would be running away with it were he white. I mean, I think that the voters made that pretty clear, that they liked the Democrats' economic policies, but they weren't sure about Obama. Now, there's a lot of other factors that are coming in, his relatively brief time in the Senate, the sort of, you know, question about, you know, what he's done versus what John McCain has done. But it is clearly a very big factor in this race. Now, some of them did say, I'm going to vote for him anyway.
How about the vice presidential candidate with Obama, Senator Joe Biden?
Oh, well, he's from Scranton, which is from the neighboring county.
I'm wondering if that helps counter any of the racial overtones.
So many people said to me, Joe Biden left the area when he was 10. It doesn't mean anything to me that he was from Scranton. Now, neither Biden and Obama could probably spend some more time in this county. And if Biden did, he'd probably get some of those people, because it is very Catholic and very ethnic. Lots of, you know, sort of pierogies for sale everywhere, Polish families. So there's probably some, you know, votes there to be mined, and both of the campaigns will be mining them. But as of now, Biden is not much of a factor in this area.
All right. Andrea, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Andrea Bernstein, the Takeaway's political director. Also in the studio with us is Rebecca Traister. She covers gender, media, and politics for Salon.com. Rebecca, we're going to get her to stick around with us for the rest of the hour. Meanwhile, a new report shows that when the economy tanks, the sales of breakfast foods, they go up. And as you're starting your day, we wanted to know, what are you having for breakfast? Michael in Manhattan shared this.
I normally sleep much later than this, but the cool weather in New York got me up early today, and I'm going out to get myself a ham steak for breakfast. You kids have fun.
I like that. Gonna go get me a ham steak. Catherine, not me, sent us an email and said that for breakfast I have a cup of strong coffee and sometimes the cereal my sons don't finish. You tell us what's for breakfast at your house. 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email. mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji. from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Friday, September 19th. I'm Catherine Lanford, in for both Adora Udoji and John Hockenberry. Now, with me in the studio is Rebecca Traister. She writes about media, gender, and politics for Salon.com. And here's a question. What is it with politicians and their cycles? It seems that every 4 years, suddenly it's cool to be female. Have you noticed a sea change when it comes to talk about sexism?
I will be honored to accept your nomination for Vice President of the United States.
It's time for a woman to make it to the White House.
No, mine! It's supposed to be mine.
Senator Clinton has received her fair share of the blame, and so has her political team. But like her or not, one of the great lessons of that campaign is the continued and accepted role of sexism in American life.
But tonight we are crossing party lines to address the now very ugly role that sexism is playing in the campaign.
An issue which I am frankly surprised to hear people suddenly care about.
That, of course, is Sarah Palin and Hillary Clinton. And then Amy Poehler and Tina Fey. Rebecca, I get them mixed
amazing.
Up.
It's amazing. They just mix right together, don't they?
They do. And, you know, there was Katie Couric thrown in there. And have you noticed that she has sort of been rehabbed in the press lately?
I certainly have. She got a big rehab in the New York Times just this week. And it looks like she's going to be interviewing Palin herself. She's going to get her shot after Charlie Gibson. It looks like everybody's taking another look at Katie Couric after she was basically left for dead on CBS after she first took over as the first woman evening news anchor. We're experiencing one of those every 4 year up with girls moments in American politics. This one more intense than any I've seen in my life.
But, so why do you think that is?
Well, it's because of the historic nature of Hillary Clinton's run, and now we have Sarah Palin. Now, when Hillary was running, we didn't talk much about the fact that she was a woman. Because that, you know, she chose to do that and the media chose to do that. We didn't talk about sexism and feminism with regard to Hillary as much because that was a sort of threatening concept. But now Sarah Palin has come in and everybody got so thrilled about her. She was a woman and the Republicans are talking about sexism and Rick Santorum is telling us how to talk about women. So suddenly...
Your voice can't help but go up, I can tell.
Suddenly, everybody... wants to have a, you want women? We got girls. We got Katie Couric. We got a whole movie about women, although that didn't work as well so far.
No, but you know, when you think about it, there was both Mamma Mia and the Sex and the City film this summer. And this is always sort of ironic if you do keep track of these things. Every time that there is a female-centric movie that makes a lot of money, there is shock. Shock.
The American culture... in general, is like Mr. Short-Term Memory. Like every 4 years, every 3 years, whenever we have a movie about women that makes money, everybody goes, oh my God, women have money. Women have political capital. Women matter. We should really do more for women. And then they forget. And a year goes by or 4 years go by or 8 years go by and suddenly they remember again. We're in one of those stages, I think.
And so what are the odds that this one will have a little more lasting power?
Well, that depends on who you think is going to get elected in November. I mean, there's a real question about where this is going to go. So much has been made of Palin's gender. It's so funny how more has been made of it than in some ways was made of Hillary's gender. That's going to make a difference. If we had a woman vice president, it is going to change the way we talk about gender and power. We can argue about whether it's good or bad.
I was just going to say... Given that, you know, there are those who would argue that we would still not be talking about women truly in power. So,
oh, yeah, we would not. We would be talking about it as we're talking about feminism and sexism with regard to a candidate who also is dead set in her policy against a variety of women's rights and women's issues. So the language can be used around it. That doesn't mean that we're going to see an increase in power. But if McCain-Palin lose, I think we're going to lose that element of our conversation. We'll go back to forgetting that women can run for office or attract votes.
All right. Given your theory that we have this cyclical thing that every 4 years, in order to win votes, Suddenly, politicians pay more attention to women. Tell me, in the zeitgeist out there, what's going on with men? I mean, are they being ignored?
Oh, well, this happens to be coming at exactly this moment when there's a spate of books out there about what's happening to the American man. There's a book called Guyland and the Decline of Men, all about to hit shelves. Even Alec Baldwin's book about how men are mistreated in divorce courts and in custody hearings, that's about to come out. The shelves are going to be lined this fall with books about what is happening to masculinity in this country, and it's withering, it's dying. Guys don't know what to do with themselves. Meanwhile, women are taking over the world. You know, you wouldn't know that from the fact that in our entire country's history, we never, in fact, have had a female president. But
One other quick question. What is it going to take for women to stay politically relevant after this election, no matter who wins?
Well, every 4 years, I sort of wind up railing on the same subject. We have to keep having these conversations, whether or not we have, a candidate with secondary sexual characteristics up, you know, running for office, or whether the women's vote is going to matter. We still have to talk about issues that matter to women, the economy, the reproductive rights, how women feel about foreign policy, all of this stuff. We just forget about it as soon as November passes. Women cease to matter in the cultural conversation again.
Okay, Rebecca Traister covers media, gender, and politics for Salon.com. You're going to stick around.
I am going to stick around.
Okay, and now we're going to go to Femi Oke, who's here with some headlines.
Thank you very much. Just coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. Stocks appear headed for a big rally this morning on the news the government is crafting a rescue plan for the nation's financial institutions. Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson and Fed Chair Ben Bernanke are putting together a massive rescue plan to buy up souring assets held by banks and other financial institutions. And overseas markets have been surging higher. The Hong Kong's Hang Seng Index led the way with a gain of more than 9%. Other urgent financial efforts include a Treasury Department move to tap up to $50 billion from a Depression-era fund to insure the holdings of eligible money market mutual funds. And the SEC has temporarily banned short-selling shares in nearly 800 financial institutions. The mayor of Galveston, Texas, says the city is not in ruins, but it remains a mess, and she's asking people to stay away for another week. And there's some power, but only in hospitals, and not enough in some spotty cell phone service. Health officials are calling it a public health emergency. There's not much good news around this week, Catherine, unfortunately.
No, it doesn't sound like
it. This next story might cheer you up, though. Mm. Today is International Speak Like a Pirate Day, mateys.
No.
I might be sorry I started this, but here's
you're making this up.
No, I'm not. Here's a little inspiration from Captain Jack Sparrow.
It is my intention to commandeer one of these ships, pick up a crew in Tortuga, raid, pillage, plunder, and otherwise pilfer my Weasley black guts out.
Okay, that's a little bit of inspiration. International Talk Like a Pirate Day is September the 19th every year for the full story and some good phrase and some helpful hints on how to speak like a pirate. You can listen to Catherine or you can go to www.talklikeapirate.com.
Thank you, wench.
I'm scared. That's your news.
Don't be scared.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer cash rewards to students for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it like merit bonuses in business? Viewpoints at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Friday, September 19th. I'm Catherine Lanfer in for both Adora Udoji and John Hockenberry. Now, the markets just opened at 9:30 this morning, which means just a few minutes ago, and we are watching the Dow Jones Industrial Average, and it is climbing as I speak to you, 248 points up right now. It's only been open for a few minutes. Now, as you know, this has been a very volatile week, the roller coaster. It goes up and it goes down. But in the wake of this roller coaster, everyone wants to know when the troubles on Wall Street hit Main Street. New York Times economics writer Lewis Louis Uchitel has a suggestion that what you should do is take a look at your credit card statement. You know, Louis, I would much rather look at this climbing Dow Jones index than look at my credit card statement. I never want to look at that.
Well, no one likes to look at it unless you've somehow lost the credit card for the month and not used it.
Yeah, okay. So, but if we look at it, what is it going to tell us about the trickle-down effect, if you will, of Wall Street to Main Street?
Well, what's happening is that the credit troubles on Wall Street are making lenders and the numerous failures, debt failures, are making lenders very cautious about who they lend to. And so that you have your credit card company lowering the limit that you're allowed to charge on your credit card so that they'll be sure to be repaid. You have mortgage lenders saying, look, we're going to give you a mortgage only if you put 20% down on your house as a down payment on the house. We're not going to give you credit if you have a credit history of failing to repay previous loans. And we're not going to give you credit unless you not only have a job but earned a certain amount of money. They're doing everything they can, the lenders, to limit losses in the future.
All right. And so despite the problems with credit, why is it that it looked like consumer spending rose for June and July?
No, it fell for June and July.
Oh.
Yes, it rose nominally for June and July. But if you adjust for inflation, it turns out that you actually were ending up buying fewer things than in the previous months. You're likely to have in August also a decline in purchases of by the public. What you're getting then is connecting it with credit. You go to you can't get as much credit as you had before, and so you don't buy as much. That's one of the things. And also people are scared, just plain scared. They're not sure what's happening to their savings, invested in the stock market or invested even in CDs. They're not. They wake up every morning and they see one big bank investment back after another, investment bank one after another failing, and they pull back themselves. So they're not getting as much credit to make purchases as before in a society that depended on credit to thrive for more than a decade. And two, they're running into a very scary situation, not unlike the oil embargo, which scared us back in the early 70s.
You know, the Associated Press is telling us this morning that the Treasury is saying that it will provide temporary guarantees for the nation's money market mutual funds. In fact, a response to that very fear-based action you've been talking about.
Exactly. I mean, as I was writing the story yesterday, the situation changed. It seemed very unlikely in the mid-afternoon that there would be any help from Congress in this short, brief session. And then before the night's over, there's talk of a bailout, of Congress authorizing the government to, in effect, buy the bad debts of the banks and thus remove their troubles from their troubled lending from their books. Something like that happened during the Great Depression, and a minor version of it happened during the SNL crisis in the late 80s, early 90s, and now it's going to happen maybe on a large scale. This crisis is moving very quickly, and the government, the Federal Reserve, the Treasury, everybody is trying to find some way to stop it.
Okay, Lou, I have a question. You spoke so movingly about how scared people are, and I'm assuming that everyone in your life, because of what you do for a living, is calling you to say, Lou, tell me what's going on. Tell me what I should do. So what are you telling these people?
Well, not too many people are calling.
Well, okay, well, Lou, I've got your number, so I'm going to call you when the show's over.
All right?
I'm scared. What should I do?
Well, I'm telling people to relax a little bit. If they're on the stock market, they might take some losses for a while. Remember, The money you have in the banks is fully insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the federal government, so you run no risk of a loss of your savings in the banks, up to $100,000 in each bank. And we haven't much, despite all these troubles and all the freewheeling dealings of the last 10 years, we have a much better system than we had back in the 20s and 30s to protect us from this type of crisis.
All right. Lewis, you should tell. We're going to have to let you go. I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Lewis Uchitel is the economics writer for our partner, the New York Times. Now we're going to turn to Femi Okeh in the latest from the newsroom.
Thank you very much, Catherine. Good morning, everybody. Just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Urgently moving on multiple fronts to stem the worst financial crisis in decades, the government announced plans this morning to take two historic steps. First, the Treasury will tap up to $50 billion from a Depression-era fund to ensure the holdings of eligible money market mutual funds. Second, the SEC has temporarily banned on short selling on nearly 800 financial institutions. This is all happening as Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson and Fed Chair Ben Bernanke are crafting a massive rescue plan to buy up some dodgy assets held by troubled banks and other financial institutions at the heart of the nation's financial crisis. North Korea says it will rebuild one of its major nuclear reactors after almost completely disassembling it earlier this year, and it's announced it doesn't care anymore if the US takes it off the terrorism blacklist. The US's reluctance to do that is what they said prompted the reversal on dismantling the reactor. And finally, Microsoft is dropping its new ad campaign, which featured Bill Gates and Jerry Seinfeld. In their place is a series of TV ads that focus on people who use Windows.
Hello, I'm a PC, and I've been made into a stereotype.
I'm a PC, and I'm not what you call hip.
I'm a PC, and I wear glasses.
I wear glasses.
Hey, I wear glasses.
I wear jeans, and I study jeans.
I think you get the idea of the ad, and it actually does mention Windows, which the first ad with Bill Gates and Jerry Seinfeld didn't.
Hey, you know, you were talking about Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson.
Yes.
Fed Chair Ben Bernanke. The Dow Jones has gone up to 371 points.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, and this is The Takeaway. Now, take a listen to these words and see if you can figure out who this legendary ABC anchor is talking about.
This is Howard K. Smith in Washington. Since women have been knocking on the gates of power, they've forced most of them open. They have won the top places in business and scholarship. They have become governors of state. They have become congressmen and senators in Washington. They have become judges on the federal bench. But the topmost place, the presidency, has remained beyond even their serious imaginings. This lady seeks to change that, and in a sense, she already has.
No, it's not Sarah Palin, and it's not Hillary Clinton. That recording was made in 1964.
Senator Margaret Chase Smith of Maine has become the first woman ever openly to seek the presidential nomination of a major party. In the 5 weeks since she began campaigning, the idea has at least stopped being unthinkable. If she runs strongly in the primaries, she might be essential as a vice presidential nominee on a ticket. And if the ticket won, she would be that famous single heartbeat from the top. And then, well, much more unlikely things have happened in American history.
44 years ago, Republican Senator Margaret Chase Smith was the first woman to have her name placed in nomination by either of the major parties. Now, a lot has changed since then, but other things haven't. Chase Smith was a widow, and so on the TV program Issues and Answers, Howard Smith just had to ask her this.
A question of minor importance but great interest. Every president has a first lady or hostess. If you became president, who would be your host in the White House?
Well, I haven't thought about that. I've been in the Congress for 23 years without one. I presume I could get along in the White House without a husband, if that's what you mean.
Chase Smith had been getting along just fine because she had plenty of experience. Not that everyone always saw it or acknowledged it in a woman.
I hope that the women who are not talking will really think, and I think they will, think whether which one is more qualified, meets the requirements that she or they want. I'm hoping that will be the result. And I'm of the opinion that women don't vote for women because they're women. They vote for the one they think is best able to serve.
Now, as for international experience, oh, yeah, that was that foreign trip she took. Oh, and the whole Russia thing.
With Mr. Khrushchev, you have read, no doubt, that he called me an Amazon warmonger hiding behind a rose. After I made that speech on the nuclear posture, he said that I was that cannibalistic little woman. I must be a savage woman. So I must have some standing, and I have had on my world trip in 1955, I had conferences with the leaders of, I think, 23 countries.
Republican Senator Margaret Chase Smith speaking in 1964, the same year Governor Sarah Palin was born. Rebecca Traister is here from Salon.com. Pretty amazing, huh?
It's amazing. You don't know really whether to laugh or to cry.
I don't know. I like the fact that she could get along just fine in the White House. She knew exactly what to do with that question about whether she needed a man or not to be president.
Well, she'd had 23 years experience with no formal host spouse in Congress. So what was she worried about?
And I think she liked being called an Amazonian warmonger.
Oh, I think, didn't she say, well, so you know I'm serious.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to be back with more here on The Takeaway.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for both Adora Udoji and John Hockenberry. We're going to turn now to Femi Oke with the latest headlines.
Thanks, Catherine. Coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The government is working on a plan to rescue banks from bad debts. The legislation could take some of the immediate pressure off the two remaining major independent investment banks, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, to reach deals to ensure a steady flow of funds for their operations. The Dow is already up 400 points. It's following the lead of other global markets, which surged today. Share values in London, Paris and Frankfurt all registered significant gains. Stock markets in Asia also rallied. And Catherine, how are we doing here in the US?
I was just going to say, we have the S&P 500, which looks like it's up more than 52 points. The NASDAQ composite looks like it's up more than 86 points. And the Dow Jones, as you said, more than 400. It's fluctuating, but looks like 406 right now.
But we got green arrows going up. Which
yes, that is what we're talking. Green arrows going up.
Very nice. And moving on with the news, residents in Detroit woke up to a new mayor. Former Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick stepped down at midnight and was replaced by City Council President Ken Cockrell Jr. Cockrell, who's the son of a prominent attorney and city activist, will take over in a public ceremony this afternoon. And Kilpatrick will go to jail next month for lying under oath. And a new study says that voters in some swing states can expect problems at the polls this November. The nonpartisan group Common Cause found various problems with voting machines, voter identification and verification in Florida, Georgia and Virginia. And finally, don't forget, it is International Speak Like a Pirate Day. I dare you, Catherine. I dare
Arrgh.
You.
All right, you wench. Get out of here. Let me get on with my show. Ha, ha, ha. I can't believe I just did that. All right, moving right along. Although almost every American is feeling the repercussions of this week's roller coaster markets, quit staring at me, Femi. There is one sector that has actually seen an increase in business. General
yes.
Mills, the company that makes Cheerios and Yoplait yogurt, saw sales of breakfast cereals rise 10% from a year ago. Yogurt sales, in fact, were up 19%. Well, it seems that in times of economic trouble, we eat around our kitchen table more than we go out. And we're wondering, do you have a favorite breakfast indulgence when times are tough?
Hi, I'm Jim from New Jersey, and when times are tough, I eat things with lots of fiber in them. I figure with all the tough times, regularity is probably a good thing. Thank you.
Well, who's going to argue with that? Call our Spinvox line at 877-MY-TAKE or leave us a message at thetakeaway.org. We're going to hear your suggestions for breakfast, but first we're going to go to Takeaway contributor Mary Beth Williams, who's with us here in the studio. Okay, Mary Beth, is breakfast back?
Breakfast is back. Forget sexy. It's now all about breakfast. I brought in some food here. I don't know. I still haven't eaten. All I've eaten so far this morning is a half a bite of some fully cooked bacon from Oscar Mayer. You can buy it already cooked. And they say it's delicious or your money back. But yes, General Mills, everything is up. Also huge this year, oatmeal. Oatmeal is the new black. Two weeks ago, Starbucks rolled out a new menu, and the cornerstone of it is oatmeal. If you go to the supermarket, I was there yesterday with my children, the amount of real estate that the warm, soft food is taking up is huge. I think
warm, soft food.
Get out of high tech. Get into soft food. That's where I'm putting my whole portfolio now.
Well, no, I mean, instead of tough economic times, it sounds like we have tough gums. What's going on?
We may have tough times call for soft teeth. Maybe that's the issue there. But
it's easy for us to make light, isn't it?
It is because we still have all of our incisors. But yeah, it's a big stuff. Kellogg's is also posting gains for this quarter. Cereal is up. Yogurt is up. I mean, part of that is that in tough times, it's what's known as the trading down effect. When the economy gets bad, what's the first thing to go? Maybe it's going to be your $4 Frappuccino that you got on the road.
Well, I couldn't help but think, and we've had people tell us this morning, and that is, times are tough. Maybe people go to cereal for dinner.
That's another thing, too, is that it's not just that was one of the things that was in this report is that, cereal is now a replacement meal. It's not just cereal's not just for breakfast anymore. And people are eating in more. There's a lot less eating on the road, eating even in your car.
You mentioned a report. Where's this report from?
There was a big report in the Financial Times this week. There's also a Reuters report. And there was a report done by a marketing company. There's a marketing company that did a report on dining out. And even though the breakfast sector is up in terms of where people are eating, most of the economy is people are eating in more.
We have another culture observer here, and that is Rebecca Traister, who reports for Salon.com. And what... I could see you raising your hand, and I don't think you were going toward the pre-cooked bacon.
Well, we're sitting here. Mary Beth has brought in the pre-cooked bacon and a number of breakfast options. And in talking about the comforting feeling of breakfast and soft-cooked foods, I couldn't help but look with horror and bemusement at a product called Coco Crispies Cereal Straws. Chocolatey, crunchy tubes for milk sippin' fun.
And that's sippin' with an apostrophe. The big winner in all of this is going to be the apostrophe. Because we're sipping, we're dunking, we're eating, we're dining, we're noshing.
Well, in my youth, I didn't have the milk sipping fun chocolate straws. And I have this vision of our breakfast for dinner with using your chocolatey milk sipping straws to sip your beer or wine.
that is repurposing.
There are some innovations that I'm not sure needed to be made.
Maybe that's it. It's a cocktail hour. It's the sipping teeny that we're going to have. Yeah, it's an all hours kind
ladies,
of a thing.
Ladies, get a hold of yourselves here. We're supposed to be talking about breakfast. And I have to say, frankly, you lost me when, if someone can't fry up their own bacon, you don't get to eat it.
Well, it says on the box that it's so that you can enjoy bacon as part of any meal. I say every meal, but...
Don't get me started on what this says about the American kitchen.
You can eat bacon in every meal.
Absolutely, you can.
Let's not question that.
That's what I like. But what I also brought in today, because, times are tough and we're all a little sad and we're all a little scared. So one of the things I found at the supermarket yesterday was some Optimum Zen cereal for inner harmony, and it promises to bring back the peaceful sigh of being in tune with yourself.
We just had someone call in about this, and it's called regularity.
Yeah, it's blended with soy to provide you with serenity and calm. I need a bigger box. This 12.5 ounces is not going to cut it for my economic
fears.
Could
we bathe in Optimum Zen?
I send it down to Wall Street. We need a lot more. Send it to the Fed. That's it. We just have some Optimum Zen cereal.
But here's a serious question. I guess apparently I am I'm the person that's going to bring us all down here. I thought cereal was expensive.
Cereal is expensive. But cereal is less expensive than going out. I called up Norma's restaurant today. It's at the Park Meridian where they have a $1,000 breakfast if you want to get...
I bet that's taken off the menu soon.
I was wondering how many of them they've moved this week. It's called the Zillion Dollar Lobster Frittata, and it's $1,000. And they say on the menu, we dare you to expense this. The person that I spoke to at Norma says they've sold about 12 of them total. They haven't sold any this week, but they also have a $100 version, and they move about 12 of those a month. If you don't want the $100 breakfast, you can go home and have a bowl of cereal. But cheaper yet, we've got oatmeal. We go back to that. Nothing is cheaper, easier than oatmeal.
I just want to put a breakfast cam at that restaurant to see if anyone has the temerity.
Who has the moxie?
It would really take some.
I want to know what your favorite breakfasts are. You know, if all the stars are aligned and magically your favorite breakfast appears, what is it going to be?
Oh, it's everything. Well, there's got to be bacon. Cooked bacon, real bacon, Applewood smoked bacon. But I think there's just nothing better than a bagel with lox and cream cheese. That's as good as it gets.
Pizza.
And now there's breakfast pizza.
Hang on a minute.
Bacon.
Is it cold or is it hot?
It's cold. But it's definitely cold. I'll take it hot, though, too.
And I somehow have the sense that you would have some milk with that and a sip and straw.
Mm-hmm, a sip and straw.
Yeah. In a mimosa.
You were talking about breakfast pizza? This sounds like a good idea.
This is another new thing. I mean, we're getting more international in our flavors love. So if you do go out for breakfast, a lot of restaurants, it's kind of started in Chicago, you can get the fried egg. Why not? Pizza
we're getting
is just...
more international. You're trying to sell me breakfast pizza? Au contraire,
my friend.
It's
very continental.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Just stick with the oatmeal. It's cheap, it's fast, and it will apparently keep you regular. And as we all get a little older, maybe we need to outsource that.
That's Mary Beth Williams, takeaway contributor. Also, our friend from Salon.com, Rebecca Traister. There's lots of ways to catch up with us here at The Takeaway. You can find us on Twitter, Friend Feed, and Facebook. Now, we had someone who wrote in today who was responding not only to our female power segment, but also to what she had for breakfast. Frederica writes, as a black woman, I should be in charge of everything, right? Or does the power of the blackness cancel out the power of the femaleness? Because I'm eating leftover pasta for breakfast, I'm doing laundry by hand, and not feeling that the world is mine. Give us your take at thetakeaway.org. I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry and Adore You Doji. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.